Good morning once again. Welcome to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue for a few mornings this week, and I promise it will only get better than that. I am joined this morning in studio for the Roundtable panel discussion by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Delighted to be here. So excited to be hosting. This will be fun.
Sure. Also joined by senior fellow at Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer. Morning, Jim. How's it going?
Good morning. Happy to be here.
And we are also joined, she's joining us remotely today, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post is on the line. Hello, Libby.
Hey there. How are you all doing?
We're all right. How are you? How are you feeling?
It's a challenge, but I'll get there. Let me just say that I had friends here at the beginning, and I didn't remember how painful the other replacements were. And they said, yes, you don't. Just like you don't remember how painful childbirth is, which, of course, I've never been through.
Right.
But
same.
I'll take their word for it.
What did you, so the listeners aren't terribly concerned, what did you have replaced?
I had my right hip replaced.
Okay. And that was a couple of weeks ago, and your recovery is going all right.
Yeah. Good. About 10 days.
Good. Well, wishing you, you know, comfortable healing, and we'll see you again in studio soon, but hear from you today.
Thank you.
Of course. You can join the conversation by emailing us panel@wamc.org. That's panel, P-A-N-E-L, at WAMC.org. Before I forget to mention it, or lest I forget, the music we're playing this morning is all from Pat Metheny's new album, Moon Dial, and the playlist is posted online at... Oh, it isn't. I didn't post it yet. Don't look for it. But the music is from Pat Metheny, and I will mention it a few more times throughout the show, and I will get it online later. Once again, the email address, panel@WAMC.org. I spent most of the weekend watching Olympics coverage, but that's not what we're primarily going to discuss today because there are sort of more pressing matters. Let us discuss the latest on the Harris campaign. Democratic delegates could begin voting this week to virtually nominate Kamala Harris as early as Thursday, the date of the Democratic National Committee said it expected to start that process if only one candidate had emerged, and one candidate has essentially emerged. Harris will be narrowing her choices for a running mate, having set an August 7th deadline for that. The Harris campaign said on Sunday that it had raised $200 million in the week since President Biden withdrew from the race, more than Biden's haul in the first 3 months of the year. Roughly two-thirds of that amount came from first-time donors, according to the campaign, offering another sign that Ms. Harris's ascent to the top of the party's ticket has invigorated Democratic voters. The campaign has also said that it signed up more than 170,000 new volunteers. So quite a lot of momentum, a lot of eyes on the VP pick. What are we thinking about the Harris campaign? I'll start with you, Jim.
Yeah, there's. I think because it's such an unusual year, and every week, every day seems to be another surprise. There's been all of this buildup about the VP choice, and understandably so. I think, I'm especially interested to hear what Teresa and Libby think about the real effects of the choice in the end. Does it really matter that much or not? But for the moment, it's very entertaining, very interesting. It's kind of like a lottery. Who's going to be picked? And you know, there was this article that was focusing on the people who are in the running to be VP, but were also former attorneys general. I like to use the proper,
of course,
plural there. Attorneys general, like Whoppers Jr. And so Roy Cooper from North Carolina, Andy Beshear in Kentucky, and Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania, and you know, they all seem to have the right kind of background. They're in the right kind of states. They could be viable. somebody who wasn't an attorney general, but I think is still on that list and would be, I think, a strong choice is Senator Mark Kelly from Arizona, an astronaut. Navy pilot.
That's Teresa's border, choice.
A border state.
She's been saying.
Yeah. And okay. I think it'd be hard to top all of that as well. So it's interesting. It's entertaining. It's getting a lot of news now. But I throw it to my colleagues who know more about this than I do to say, well, how much does it really matter?
Libby?
Oh, I think it matters quite a bit. And I get it, Jim, that you think it's entertaining, but this is much more than that. It is crucial to the to the existence of our democracy, honestly. I think that the pick needs to be able to help in a swing state. Now, Andy Beshear, who is governor of either Kansas or Kentucky.
It's Kentucky. Kentucky. He's 46 right. years old.
Right. He's 46. He's young. She's 47 or so. You know, they both are that generation, which is great. It's like the JFK generation, because he was of that age when he was elected. And he's from a
we want to, Libby, sorry to interrupt, want to correct, Kamala Harris is 59 years old. 59.
Oh, she's 59. She is. Oh, I thought she was younger than that. Doesn't really matter. She's still quite generating young. An incredible amount of excitement.
Yes.
From the younger demographic. But he would be able to possibly blunt the Christian right's impact on the campaign in the voting moving forward because of the state that he represents, right? It's a very red state, and he's been reelected there. He's been elected and reelected as a Democrat while Trump got elected on the ticket. And so it's been interesting to see how that will play out. Josh Shapiro, Pennsylvania, another swing state, which is needed to win this, that's for sure. Now, the question is, okay, how diverse will this country accept as a ticket, right? You have Kamala Harris, who's a woman of color, South Asian descent, and you have Josh Shapiro, who's Jewish. And I wonder whether or not the country as a whole would accept that kind of diversity on the ticket. I would hope that they would. I wonder whether or not it would impact the further left of the Democratic Party, given everything that's going on in the Middle East. I think this time around, especially with J.D. Vance, it's sort of like, you know, Trump's Sarah Palin as his pick. I think the VP pick will be consequential and will make a difference. And it's also about having a surrogate out there, someone who can take the swings that the presidential candidate shouldn't necessarily be doing, although we all know that Trump's going to do what he's going to do regardless, and that Kamala has to rise above it, yet with her, should I say, panache and oratory ability, be able to cut him down to size. It's the best way I can put it on the air.
Teresa.
The vice president pick, I think, is very interesting. One of the things that I've learned, sort of broadening my awareness about the VP pick in the last few days, is reading, you know, traditionally I've always thought about it as key to helping the person get elected, you know, with swing states, and that's scary. But there's been some research writing on this that says that it really doesn't matter that much, you know, as people have gone back and analyzed it in terms of winning the swing states. But what really has made a difference is how they help a person govern. And so, for instance, you really saw that with the President Obama-Biden selection, because President Obama did not have a lot of congressional experience, relatively new senator when he was elected president. But he brought in Vice President at the time, Biden, now President Biden, who really was quite skilled at legislative wrangling, shall we say, and out of that comes things like the Affordable Care Act, where he, you know, really spent a lot of time on the Hill putting together these packages. And then in the reverse, you saw his skills really in the last 3 years building what is a historic legislative achievement, whereas Vice President Harris really shined after the Dobbs decision, where she was out around the country building up a network around the reproductive health rights issues. And you've seen that in other places. So I think while each of these, I still think it, intuitively it must matter some, although some of the research says that it doesn't, I think it you need to think about it. I think everyone says what matters most in the end is chemistry. how do they get along? Can they work with each other? I mean, is it a good fix? One of the things I was realizing when I was reading various stories about the various options, the governors and such, is what a network she has. Like, she has worked with, for more than 10, 15 years, with a number of these governors that are being considered because they had been AGs in the past or in some way she had crossed paths with them. But as to who I think, I mean, if people have been listening for a month or more, I really think that the best choice here, if the chemistry is right, is the senator from Arizona, Senator Mark Kelly. He is certainly tested under difficult situations. You don't live in the space station without being tested.
Right, he's a Navy veteran and former astronaut.
Yeah, Navy veteran, former astronaut. He flew 39 combat missions. He flew four missions to space, to the space station. He commanded two of those. But he also, I think a key thing, and there was a great New York Times piece, a deep dive into this the other day, he's from a border state and has a deep understanding of the border issues and worked with Senator Lankford and others to craft the compromise border bill that the Trump came in and blew up at the last minute. And so in the campaign discussions where immigration and border issues will be key, he has a deep understanding of that and can push back on that issue. The other thing he spoke aggressively about, and I think is the reproductive health issues, he talks about his own experiences with his wife and IVF and about the fact that he has daughters and grandchildren. And then lastly, we can't not talk about his wife, who, when we have an atmosphere here of political violence and we see what hate speech does and gun violence, his wife, Gabby Giffords, the awesome Gabby Giffords, was a victim of gun violence, and together they have a foundation that addresses those issues. And he talks about being a gun owner, but gun safety issues. So on a range of issues, he's really good. But what he brings that the others don't is the foreign policy experience.
You know what I think might also raise the stakes on this choice is that on the Republican side, J.D. Vance seems to be stumbling out of the gate, is coming under a lot of scrutiny, even from the Republican side, mm-hmm. and maybe some buyer's remorse about that. So there may be both a political vulnerability and an increased just attention on the VP position on both sides. I also have taken note that Pete Buttigieg has been on the air a lot lately. Mm-hmm. He's been seems to be sent out, and he's, by my estimation, just doing a fantastic job answering tough questions and articulating both the Biden record to this point and the case for Kamala Harris going forward. And, you know, I think in one way or another, he is going to be playing an important role going forward in this race, even just doing what he's doing now, which is being sent out to take the tough questions and articulate the message.
And you really see that, and we talked about this a bit on Friday, so pardon if people were listening and I'm repeating myself, but it's such an astounding group of people, bench of people, and others as well, who are really going out and making the case. And you saw that this weekend, where what I think is interesting is not just the Veep stakes right now, but I think also this just incredible outpouring of engagement. If I might shift to that for a minute and wind it back in. Because you heard the reports over the last week of, first of all, there was the after she was selected, the phone call with 40,000 African-American women, a group that had already been meeting via Zoom. And then that led to four or five other calls. And in the end, you had just enormous number of people signing up to volunteer. So my question was, were they going to turn volunteer into action? And in fact, immediately they have. There was a whole weekend of action all over the country. And you saw a lot of these surrogates in Pennsylvania, in Minnesota, in Michigan. And the one that I was completely fascinated by was, I don't know if people are familiar with the Villages in Florida, but it's mm-hmm. a very, very, very mm-hmm. conservative enclave and a place that Trump's gone and great, great cheers. And they had, and people move around there in golf carts, and they had a golf cart rally for Kamala Harris, where there were hundreds of golf carts doing a little golf cart ride through the Villages with these decked out golf carts with Kamala Harris signs and stuff. I thought, if this is permeated into the Villages, oh my goodness, it's incredible.
That's quite an image, by the way.
It
the
was.
Golf
look
cart
at
rally.
Look it up. It's just in the, you know, it's amazing. And I was listening to there was an interview with three different people who do organizing. One is a woman who started a group called Red Wine and Blue. Katie Paris, she has been organizing since 2018 midterms and in response to Trump, and brings peer-to-peer organizing, and then Swing Left. They're a group that does the postcards, postcard writing, and then it's a group called Black Pack. They're part of the group that organizes these phone calls, not the lead one. But they were talking about how this peer-to-peer relationship activity, these gatherings like you saw with the golf carts or door knocking or whatever, that's the new postcards emergence, and these Zoom calls. And there's one tonight that's going to have over 1 million people on it.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. That's panel at WAMC.org. I do also want to point out, of course, that Vice President and presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris was in our region this weekend. She was in Pittsfield, Massachusetts on Saturday. There is coverage of her visit online, of course, at WAMC.org. You can learn more about that on our website, and we will continue our conversation after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke. The music this morning is from Pat Metheny's new album, Moon Dial. It's Moon Dial, one word, but with a capital M and a capital D. Pat Metheny, an excellent musician. The panel this morning, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. Libby, we didn't get to go back to you before we went to break. Was there anything from the prior part of the discussion you wanted to comment on?
Yes.
Okay.
There's a part of me that would really like to see Pete Buttigieg as the VP choice. And I know that that's not going to happen. However, the visual and the reality of he and J.D. Vance having a debate would go down in the political annals forever, because, I mean, Pete would just rip him apart in the way that Pete talks so succinctly, clearly, makes the argument. And J.D. Vance is, you know, just going after childless women with cats, which we all know is code for lesbian. So, you know, it would be great comic relief in some respects for the next 100 days. But Pete's not going to end up being the vice presidential pick. It would just be a little too much for the country. But I do think he will play a major role in the Harris administration. And yeah, I thought the stuff down in the down in Florida was really very interesting. And you're seeing favorability polls coming out now and other kind of polls coming out. The lead, I think Trump's lead has pretty much disappeared. And the amount of organizing that's happening. In New York State, there's a coordinated campaign effort to flip congressional seats. We're all working together to make that happen. And we're going to see that across the country, a coordinated campaign where no one is left behind, hopefully. And we'll see this blue wave. And again, I cannot stress strongly enough the strength of the women's vote. And with Harris at the top of the ticket, that vote is going to come out. And it's all about Roe. and it's about women being seen as chattel, and they do not want that to happen. And there must be change, and the women will come out to vote and make sure that Harris is elected. I feel pretty strongly about this. I'm not pie in the sky here, but Trump has sort of lost his mojo because he was planning on running against Joe and attacking him for his age. That's gone. What is he going to do? Call Harris nasty names on the air?
Yes.
I mean, that's the only thing he can do.
And he will.
Yes.
The New York Times has Buttigieg, the current Secretary of Transportation, as we've mentioned, a 42-year-old, as a less likely contender, which we've all pretty much, you know, acknowledged. Right. And he would be the first openly gay person nominated for vice president. Teresa.
Yeah, I want to reinforce what you said there, Libby, about the in New York State and helping with the key House races, because you really see that in New York State, but all over the country. That's one of the things that I've been really pleased about the discussion in the last few days, is that they are focused not just on the top of the ticket with the presidential race, which is critical, but also there seems to be teamwork in a way that they're, you know, you haven't always seen. And the state party chairs, the funding going to they're talking about it collectively, winning back the House and retaining the Senate and then winning the presidency. You really saw that with Governor Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania, did a whole series of events over the weekend and talking not just about the top of the ticket, but retaining, you know, House and Senate seats. You saw that really in Westmore doing the same thing in Maryland, and you saw that in Minnesota, really all over. And so that kind of integrated campaigning is critical because it's essential to win the presidency, but we've all seen how important it is to gain better control of the House, regain control of the House and have better control of the Senate, particularly the Senate with the Supreme Court cases. But also the point is, incredibly deep bench. One of the things that President Biden had said is that he wanted to pass the torch and have, you know, a new generation. And his, if you look at his administration, first of all, it's been steady. Trump, you know, there was a constant churn. Either people left because they couldn't take it anymore, or they got fired, or they were in legal trouble. But the Biden administration, they're really amazing people in the administration, Mitch Landrieu, you know, Pete Buttigieg, Ginni Raimondo, a whole range of people who are out there and can campaign in the next 99 days, but then have the capacity to govern in all sorts of capacities.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Jim, did you have something, or should I start reading some letters?
Let's hear some letters.
Okay, let's hear some letters. John writes in and says, how sad is it that we have to talk about whether or not the country is ready for a Jewish vice president or even a Jewish first gentleman? It really points to how much progress we still have to make against hate. We also heard from Ashley, who says, regarding the choice of Mark Kelly for VP, might he want to protect his now fragile wife, Gabby Giffords, from too much effort and exposure? You may not know, but could you discuss? Do you know anything about that, Teresa?
So she was out campaigning this weekend. I presume that they've made that calculation, or else he would have. In fact, when I first started talking about this maybe 6 or 8 weeks ago, a friend of mine emailed me and he said, that's just not, you can't put that kind of pressure on his wife. Why are you saying this? But she has been a champion for the issues she cares about. And as I say, she was out campaigning this weekend. So I think she's all in. Their foundation, there's a groundswell of various groups. I know a bunch of my friends who are environmentalists run a big national environmental call organizing, but there's also a group of gun safety folks who've been organizing, and their group Gabby Giffords Foundation gave $15 million toward this issue campaign around gun safety. But she's out there campaigning, so I'll go with her lead.
And this email from James wrote into panel at WAMC.org and says, I love the shift of calling MAGA and Trump weird. I'm also starting to hear people refer to Trump as a clown. These softer insults do diminish the severity of the situation, but they also diffuse rhetoric. It's disarming and dismissive in just the right way. It's just not cool to be MAGA anymore is one step in terms of dismantling the cult-like insanity.
One can only hope.
Well, I think one of the lines that I love with the vice president is when she says, "I know his type." And she says it in that tone where, you know, we all know his type. And I think without being caustic, she is being clear. But then she moves on to what she would do. You know, she prosecutes the case very tightly about him. And in the process of doing that, gives her resume. So she doesn't waste a lot of time on him, but is clear what she thinks of him, and then shifts on to what she will do onto the positive message. This is a really joyful campaign, and I think people have felt under stress. Maybe I'm just projecting, but
a joyful campaign that is 1 week old.
Right.
But she's yes. setting a tone, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And she's also cutting into that criticism that there was going to be about her laugh, because she's been criticized by her about her laugh for a while.
Which is sexism.
It is. But I do think they're setting a very positive tone. And anyway.
Yeah, you had mentioned her saying, "I know his type." And that's when she talks about having been a prosecutor and that she prosecuted people who had committed X crimes and Y crimes and Z crimes. And then she says, I know his type. And it makes me think that back to the choice of who might be the VP, you know, not everybody loves that she was a prosecutor. This also, it has to be navigated politically. And I think it works in general and probably is good with swing voters. But for some in the Democratic Party, there is some level of being uncomfortable with some of the things that she did as prosecutor and as her time as attorney general in California. So I think getting another former AG, another former prosecutor on the ticket might not be so good. It might be good to have somebody who doesn't have the same kind of profile. But as you said, Teresa, it comes down to chemistry. And if she's comfortable with someone from that profile, maybe that's the most important thing, at least in terms of governing. But in terms of the politics between now and up to Election Day, I think it might be good to have somebody who's not a former prosecutor, because that doesn't fly with everybody.
And I think also with some of the governors that don't bring foreign policy experience, Mark Kelly does bring that foreign policy and global perspective. I mean, no one has more global perspective than him, having seen the Earth from the space station, right?
Well, it looks pretty calm and nice from up there, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, actually, he said that that's really what focused him on climate change. And then he said, when you see the Earth from space and understand that very thin layer, and that's really what shifted his focus. Well, he has said for a long time that's what shifted his focus onto climate change.
One thing in favor of governors is that they are executives now. They know how to get stuff done,
right.
And that's also important in governing.
And so do attorney generals. And for those who have a problem with the fact that she was an attorney general, you know, okay, what would you like? The attorney generals that we had under Trump, or the attorney generals that we have, or Merrick Garland, or somebody who understands the law needs to be handled equally for everybody and not used as a cudgel. People just need to get a grip around that issue. The fact of the matter is she's going to stand up as a former attorney general, as VP, and hopefully as president. She's going to stand up for a woman's right to choose. She's going to stand up for those whose rights are being threatened to be taken away. She'll forge a better immigration policy, and maybe we'll actually be able to get something done on that level. And so, you know, I get it. Oh, they're law and order. Well, that's their job. You know, I work with district attorney candidates. That's their job. Sorry, that's what you're electing them to do. And also, those folks who don't like the fact that she was an attorney general, you know, when they need somebody to be a really good attorney general, they want a good attorney general. So, you know, we can't afford to be purists here, because if we go down that road, we will elect Trump. It's just that simple. People need to just get a grip and get on board. And I know I've said this before, and I know it makes some people angry, but I'm sorry. The fate of our democracy hangs in the balance here.
Libby Post, Jim Ketterer, and Teresa Bourgeois make up the panel this morning. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue. The email address to join the conversation is panel@wamc.org, and we will return after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement Jim Ketterer, and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, our panelists this morning. You can join the conversation by emailing us panel@wamc.org. The music during the panel this morning is from Pat Metheny's new album, Moondial. Let us talk about some comments that former President Donald Trump made on Friday. Kind of parse them out and see what we think is up with these. This is from the Washington Post. At the conclusion of a speech on Friday at the Believers Summit in West Palm Beach, Florida, Donald Trump said, I'm not doing an impression. I will not do an impression. It's so hard when you read it in his you see his cadence written out, but I'll read it in my voice, sort of. Christians, get out and vote just this time. You won't have to do it anymore. You got to get out and vote. In 4 years, you don't have to vote again. We'll have it fixed so good, you're not going to have to vote. Democrats and others interpreted the comments, that's end quote there, Democrats and others interpreted the comments as signaling how a second Trump presidency would be run, a reminder that he previously said he would not be a dictator upon returning to office except for day one. In front of a different Christian audience last month, Trump made a similar suggestion about Christians not needing to vote after this year's election. At a Faith and Freedom Coalition event in Washington, the former president said, Christians don't vote as much as they should. And he continued, quote, do you know the power you have if you would vote? You've got to get out and vote just this time. I don't care. In 4 years, you don't have to vote. Okay. In 4 years, don't vote, he said. I don't care by that time, but we'll have it all straightened out, so it'll be much different. Erica De Bruin, a professor of government at Hamilton College, whose research focuses on civil-military relations, civil war, and policing, said that Trump frequently... Everything okay, Libby?
Yeah, okay. Everything's fine.
Okay. Trump frequently makes these kinds of deliberately ambiguous statements that can be interpreted in multiple ways. But she added that to understand what another Trump presidency would involve, I think... This Erica De Bruin, the professor, says, I think it's more useful to look at his past behavior than to attempt to parse what might be the true meaning of any individual set of remarks he makes. Adding myself saying that Pete Buttigieg said a similar thing about Donald Trump many times, but also recently over the weekend, where he says, you know, I don't really care what he says because he lies all the time. But these comments, if meant as stated, quite frightening. Libby, what do you think?
Oh, I think he's a fascist. I mean, you know, it's quite clear. He said, oh, reelect me and I'll just be a dictator on day one. And, you know, oh, what's he going to do for the rest of the 365 days in 364 days in the first year and then whatever the multiple is going past that? I mean, he's really thinking that if he gets elected, and of course, Congress becomes Republican, the Christian nationalists will take over and they will implement Project 2025, which is something that a lot of us have been talking about. He's like, oh, I don't know what that is. Well, I'm sorry, but the majority of people who wrote that thing used to work for him. It's the Heritage Foundation who supports him. And, you know, now they're calling it Agenda 47. But the bottom line here is that the Project 2025 is a blueprint for fascism in this country, for Christian nationalism in this country. You know, Oklahoma and Louisiana won't be the only states with the Ten Commandments, you know, blazoned wherever they're going to do it. And he wants to be a dictator. He does not care about policy. He does not care about politics in the way that we all care about politics. Okay. He only cares about power, and that's all he thinks is important, and the ability to do whatever it is that he wants to do. We've seen that with women. We've seen that in his term as president, and it will continue. So he really does think, you elect me, I'll take care of everything. Remember, I'm the only one who can fix it, right? Remember that? Mm-hmm. And that we won't have a democracy after he is reelected, And, you know, it will be an interesting thing to see. God forbid it actually happens. But we'll see how he parses all of this out in whether or not there will be debates. I think he's afraid to debate Harris. I think that he, you know, if he does, you know, she knows his playbook already. Everybody knows his playbook. She's a lot smarter than he is. But I do think he wants to be a dictator. I think that that's what he thinks, like Putin, like the guy in Turkey, Erdogan, I can't ever remember how to pronounce his name. The strongman is who he wants to be. That's who he looks up to, and that's who he wants to emulate.
Jim Ketterer.
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear in that article people kind of dancing around saying, well, we're not really sure, it's ambiguous, how do we parse this? I think we've just become so numbed to these kinds of statements from Donald Trump that we give them some kind of, you know, ambiguity that they don't deserve. And if any other candidate for any office were to say that quote, there would be just howls of derision, and appropriately so. You know, having worked on elections around the world in many places that are trying to make a transition to democracy, or some places that are pretending to try to make a transition to democracy, you know, one of the things that they don't take for granted, and I think we do sometimes here, is just the kind of core element of one person, one vote. But what often happens in those fragile places that are trying to democratize is it becomes one person, one vote, one time. And he's saying the quiet part out loud. He's basically telegraphing that we're going to do the one person, one vote, one time. So I don't see any ambiguity. I don't see any mystery. I don't see any difficulty in parsing it. And I think we just need to hold this candidate to the standard that we would any candidate who would say such a thing. That is, quite frankly, absolutely outrageous.
Teresa.
So those words were very, very disturbing, but I was equally disturbed by what he said just before that. I went back and watched this a couple times, and something that he's just consistently been saying, and he has said it before, where he continued to assert without evidence, and I'm reading from the story here, that the 2020 election was rigged against him, and that preceded his comments about the you only have to vote once. And then he said, he kept talking about how the Democrats are going to cheat. They want to cheat. And I think that is setting people up for him saying that the election was rigged. They cheat, just creating that mindset over and over again. And Jim, I mean, you know this better than me from a global perspective, from what happens in other countries. It's undermining the public's faith in our voting, our system of voting, our election system. And I think that's so deeply, deeply damaging. Now, but I will also say that I think Trump is ultimately, you know, not a big thinker, big planner, long-term visionary in terms of wanting to take the country down this path. I think he's transactional. And I think this is transactional for him. Just like his call to Georgia, I just need 11,000, whatever the number was, votes. This says, you know, you just need to do this one time for me, because that's all he needs. He needs to win this time, because he has the court cases that he needs to protect himself from, right? So, but think about who's doing his writing. Think about Stephen Miller, who does have a bigger plan. You know, these are names that aren't familiar. And I was intrigued to read, which I didn't realize this, but the campaign speech writers. So part of this, he's reading from a teleprompter, and then he goes off in riffs. But his two campaign speech writers, I learned last night when I was doing way too deep a dive, are Vince Haley and Ross Worthington. I get going here and I keep looking. But they were proteges of Stephen Miller and Newt Gingrich, right? And this comes out of that line of thinking, where I think that they do have this long-term view. I think Trump doesn't have a lot of concern about democracy. The rules and everything in his life don't apply to him, right? Mm-hmm. And this is all part of the rules don't apply to me. But I think some people behind him are the same people behind Project 2025. They do have a deeper political long-term agenda that reaches beyond their personal politics and into this vision that you and Libby have talked about.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, Teresa. Jeff writes into panel at WAMC.org and says, I have a serious question, which has never been answered by the media to my satisfaction. It is often said that Trump follows the autocratic playbook, and he does, seriously, to an extent that's extraordinarily detailed. But he's not that smart or well-read in history. Where is he getting this playbook that he follows so well? Who's telling him this stuff or directing him to do these things? And you're saying...
Yeah, look up Vince Haley, who has co-written a number of books with Newt Gingrich. And he and Stephen Miller and Ross Worthington, and those are two names, Vince Haley and Ross Worthington, I wasn't familiar with until I read way too much about them last night. so I just happened upon this because I was interested. The other thing that they were saying is that they've done an analysis, Axios has done an analysis of his speeches. He spends less than 11% of his time talking about policy plans. And most of it is this broader rhetoric. But I think for him, it's transactional. But for them, it's deeper than that, which is Project 2025. And I love the thing that went around on Facebook, and I'm sure on Instagram, which is our Project 2024 is to stop their Project 2025.
Mm-hmm. Right. But well. I think to answer the guy's question, mm-hmm. He ran a business for however many years, right? He reveled in the ability on television to say, you're fired, right? All of that media personality, the he knows how to work the media, he always has. His ability to fool people, the banks in particular, that's an autocratic way of doing business. And that was his training ground, was business. And a no holds barred perspective on I can do whatever I want.
But remember, Libby, that let's go in the way, way back machine. When he was running a campaign in 2016 that was faltering until the Mercers essentially came in and injected a bunch of money, but people. And they put people around him. They put Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway. And I think that's when Stephen Miller came on and others. And I think that their agenda was overlaid on his, you know, persona, which is willing to not follow the rules, right? And it became this combination that then just strengthened his campaign and got us to where we are today. But I think that I just don't think he came to this with a deep philosophical view that people like Stephen Miller have and Duke Gingrich has about where they want to take the country, which is, I think...
No, I remember reading a thing from the 80s saying, you know, oh, if I ran as a Republican, these people are too stupid. They would elect me. And then he's become that. But, you know, I get the fact that the Mercers and Steve Bannon and all these people came in. But the personality trait was already there of being an autocrat. They just gave him a different playbook.
Right. And the, just the no adherence to rules. I mean, you think about it in with his transactional nature with Bitcoin, where he was against Bitcoin until recently when they want to give him money. And then he was this weekend speaking at the Bitcoin convention. You think of it with Elon Musk, where he rails against electric cars and he rails against the clean energy initiative of the Biden administration, which is historic advances in clean energy. And then Elon Musk says, okay, you put J.D. Vance on, I'll give you $43 million. Okay, transactional. Now, he still starts to rail against electric cars, but then he always throws in, except for Elon Musk has good electric cars, kind of a line, right? But it's for him, it's all transactional. Sure. It's not deep philosophical views on any
of
this stuff.
No, it never has been. It's always been about what's in it for me, period.
Bill writes into panel at WAMC.org and says, Trump's remarks reveal his disdain for one of the foundations of democratic principles, the right and the need to vote. He is playing to the historic apathy of many Americans when it comes to voting. Barbara writes in and says, I don't read that much into it. He's just saying that the only thing that counts is voting for him because nothing matters but him getting elected. He's begging people, you don't have to do anything but vote this once.
I think both could be true.
Right.
You know, it's that transactional... I only care about this one time. It's all about me. And then, as you said, Teresa, all the people around him and the people are planning who are, you know, have a a sense of where they want to take the country, as you said, in the long term, that's also true.
Because he fits in there. And right. the flip side of this that I think we can't lose sight of, well, I want to just state the obvious here is, and I think that President Biden, in his speech the other day, did this eloquently. You know, the courts, it's clear that the traditional Republicans who know better and should have stepped up and stopped this became enablers. They're not going to stop this. The courts are not going to stop this. If this is going to get stopped, it's going to get stopped by voters. And it's really the bottom line is voting is what's going to, you know, stop, put, you know, make this is going to be decided by how people decide to vote. And if they come out in record numbers and voted for our democratic system, then this that'll put an end to this. And if they don't, then it's the breaking up of our democratic systems.
One of the letters that you just read talked about the apathy of American voters. And that's another thing that I'm always reminded of when I work on elections somewhere else, and particularly places that are having the first free and fair election in the history of the country, where people walk miles, they stand in the hot sun in lines, and, you know, they don't take it for granted. And I think the one of the most dangerous elements is apathy and people not engaging the body politic, and voting is kind of the bare minimum. But if people can't even muster that up, that's a very serious flaw in our system.
But one of the things that's been so encouraging, and Libby, I'm guessing you're pretty excited about this as I am, is this outpouring of desire to engage that we've seen in the last week. And you saw it in the first 48 hours, the number that I can't get over, which it just brings tears to my eyes. I know I'm goofy, but 38,000 people registered to vote in the first 48 hours after Kamala Harris was announced her intention to run. And 80% of them, more than 80%, were people under 30. And then you see tonight there's going to be like 1.5 million people on a Zoom call, if that won't bust the system. I don't know how they're going to do it, but right? And
they're paying for ultra premium
and that's,
Zoom.
That's the white men for Kamala call, right?
No, this because is the combined. This is the combined. This is the all combined? The groups. Okay. And now we're going to have one happy family tonight because they had all the various groups and tonight's supposed to be everybody. But there's also a separate call with Senator Warren, who's going to do a call explaining parts of Project 2025. I mean, right. There's all this incredible outpouring of engagement. And you saw it this weekend all over the country. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that gives me hope.
Ricky
Rodin. Let's just not forget.
Quickly,
okay? Kamala's first piece came out. It had Beyonce's song, Freedom, and the Swifties. And so when you talk about all those people under 30 who registered to vote, this is going to have a major impact.
Pop culture is back in the game.
Yeah. Right.
And don't mess with the cat lovers either, boy.
Translate into voting. That's the key.
Right.
Ricky wrote in and said Trump's outrageous statement on Friday implying that he would get rid of democracy was his attempt to steal back the media attention that, since the announcement by Biden that he's dropping out, has been wall-to-wall Kamala Harris. The media did not take the bait. It is time now for a WAMC regional newscast. We will return with more of the roundtable panel after this. Welcome back to the roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement Jim Ketterer, and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. The panel music this morning is from Pat Metheny's new album, Moondial, and you can join the conversation by emailing panel@wamc.org.
Can I just say, sorry to interrupt, I've seen Pat Metheny in concert a few times, solo and with bands.
Yeah.
If anybody out there, if you get a chance to see him, run, make sure you do it. He is really one of the great musicians of our time. He's just so fantastic. And it doesn't really matter what genre of music you think you like. Go and see him. I guarantee you're going to like it.
Beautiful. Thank you. We love that. We love an arts endorsement. Pat Metheny's new album is Moon Dial, and he has the Ketterer seal of approval as a live performance yeah. musician as well, which, you know, he also, of course, is acclaimed by many. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Before we move over to our new topic, I wanted to mention that Jen emailed in to panel at WAMC.org and says there are three calls tonight for the Harris campaign. Senator Warren's call, All Women United for Harris, and White Dudes for Harris. Those calls are all tonight. Yeah.
Yeah.
My apologies.
No problem. And then moving on, let's talk about the op-ed that current president, unbelievably, we have one, a current president, Joe Biden, still in office, of course. He has an op-ed in the Washington Post this morning. This is reading directly. It's written first person by President Joe Biden. So when I say I for the next several statements, that's who I'm referring. I am not Joe Biden, but you know what I mean. Joe Biden wrote this. First, President Biden says, I'm calling for a constitutional amendment called the No One Is Above the Law Amendment. It would make clear that there is no immunity for crimes a former president committed while in office. I share our founders' belief that the president's power is limited, not absolute. We are a nation of laws, not kings or dictators. Second, we have had term limits for presidents for nearly 75 years. We should have the same for Supreme Court justices. The United States is the only major constitutional democracy that gives lifetime seats to its high court. Term limits would help ensure that the court's membership changes with some regularity. That would make time for court nominations more predictable and less arbitrary. It would reduce the chance that any single presidency radically alters the makeup of the court for generations to come. I support a system in which the president would appoint a justice every 2 years to spend 18 years in active service on the Supreme Court. Third, I am calling for a binding code of conduct for the Supreme Court. This is common sense. The court's current voluntary ethics code is weak and self-enforced. Justices should be required to disclose gifts, refrain from public political activity, and recuse themselves from cases in which they or their spouses have financial or other conflicts of interest. Every other federal judge is bound by an enforceable code of conduct, and there is no reason for the Supreme Court to be exempt. All three of these reforms are supported by the majority of Americans, as well as conservative and liberal constitutional scholars. And I want to thank the bipartisan Presidential Commission on the Supreme Court of the United States for its insightful analysis, which informed some of these proposals. That from an op-ed in the Washington Post by President Joe Biden, proposing three changes to immunity and one change to the recent presidential immunity ruling, and two calls to change how the Supreme Court works entirely. Jim Ketterer.
Well, I think before we get to the substance of this, I think this just lays down a marker that Joe Biden does not plan on being a lame duck president, and that he's going to use his remaining time in office to be very active on many different fronts. We know that he is and going to continue to be heavily involved and on various foreign policy issues, particularly Israel, Gaza, Ukraine, but others. And other issues that, you know, are centrally important. And so this is, I think, a very strong, clear, actionable set of policies. I mean, the first one requires a constitutional amendment, which is a long, difficult process by design. The framers made it very difficult to be able to change the Constitution. But, you know, that no one is above the law. So the term limits, 18 years is a good long time. That makes perfect sense. And, you know, all of the other federal courts, as he points out in the op-ed, are held to a very high ethical standard, and the Supreme Court is not. He specifically mentions the gifts problem in the Supreme Court and the conflicts of interest as related to January 6th. So he doesn't pull any punches. He's clear. I am very interested to see how this goes forward.
Libby.
Oh, it's about time. I mean, really, I think people like Earl Warren and Felix Bamberger, they're all just sort of rolling in their graves because of what's happened to the Supreme Court. And it's no longer seen as the court that's above the law in the sense of doing the right thing, upholding the Constitution, upholding people's rights. It's now the court that takes away voting rights, right? Oh, you people over there that got your voting rights through the Voting Rights Act, you've voted enough. And if you haven't voted yet, well, that's just tough. You know, you had your opportunity and now we're going to take it away. Oh, you women over there, you've had plenty of abortions and we just don't think that that's the right thing to do anymore. And so we're just going to make sure you die because you won't have proper prenatal care or you'll be forced to carry a baby to term that might be, you know, consequential to your life, or you're going to be forced into some kind of situation where you're going to get a back alley abortion because it's no longer legal. So this Supreme Court is about as, I don't want to say the word corrupt, but morally bankrupt as I've ever experienced in my 66 years on the planet. And it makes it, you know, it makes the term kangaroo court look lofty.
Teresa.
Yeah, I'm not a student of the court, but I don't think it takes an expert to realize that their decision on whether or not a president is immune from prosecution is just stunning. And so I think that obviously this is not going to be enacted between now and when his term is up because of the, you know, because we're in an election cycle and because of the configuration of the Congress. But I think this speaks to his leadership in laying down this marker and having this be a point of discussion, because it's really these ideas are essentially going to be on the ballot, right? And I think that it's important that these kinds of ideas and debates be as part of the ballot. As an aside, today President Biden will be in Texas at the LBJ, the Johnson Presidential Library, where they're marking the 60th anniversary of the enactment of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and which was, you know, monumental piece of legislation, as I think these changes to the courts would be, not certainly to the level of the Civil Rights Act, but certainly enacting these kinds of changes would be historic changes to the court. And be far-reaching, be generational changes. And the Civil Rights Act of 64, as people know, prohibited discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, national origin. It prohibited discrimination in public accommodation, federally funded programs, and strengthened enforcement of voting rights and desegregation of the schools. So transformational indeed. And I think that we really have to be reflecting on how change happens in this country. You know, that change came after political violence, right? But it also came after public participation in ways that often put people's lives at risk while they were fighting for their own rights. And again, this gets back to who ultimately is going to make these changes. We, the people, ultimately need to stand up and make these changes while we still have a democracy.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. Jim, do you have any more comments on this?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that, you know, there was a time when the Supreme Court seemed able to police itself. There was a Supreme Court justice who was found to have taken a gift from someone who was under investigation. This was Abe Fortas in the late 1960s. And the Chief Justice went to him and said, you have to step down. And he did. But those guardrails seem to be just completely gone now. So it seems to me on this third proposal from President Biden that there has to be a binding code of conduct makes perfect sense. They should be held to the same standards as all other federal judges. But it's also, I think it bears us thinking, what has happened over the years where such an august institution is no longer able to police itself? What has been so corrosive in our body politic that what worked before no longer works? It's something that is beyond the court, and I think is important for all Americans to think about, because when these institutions corrode and trust is lost, it's very hard to put that back together again.
And I think we also need to be able to separate, as challenging it is, philosophical shifts, right? And which is the Dobbs decision versus Roe, right? That's really a philosophical shift versus ethical breaches. And I think that, you know, you're seeing now, and maybe they were happening before and just didn't come to light. But I think the point you make is that before there were guardrails with people stepping in and saying, this is not how we behave. And you really see this lack of guardrails by the enablers in this House and Senate, the Republicans who in the past, you know, when Nixon behaved the way he did, a group of Republican senators, Howard Baker and others, went to the White House and they said, this, you know, you got to go. This doesn't work for us. And those enablers stayed home this time. And here we have Trump.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. That's panel at WAMC.org. As we are discussing, President Biden made these statements, called for these actions in an op-ed in the Washington Post today, which is one of numerous ways a president could announce something. What do we think about the choice of having it be an op-ed in a major publication? Libby.
Oh, I think it was brilliant because he gets to control the message, right? If it was a press release, a press conference, there'd be questions, there'd be this, there'd be that. You don't get to control the message. When you do an op-ed, right, it's your words. You control the message. The paper prints it. It's in, you know, one of the two major newspapers in the country. I'm sure it'll end up in some of the other ones as well being reprinted. So I thought that was a great move on their part. And I just want to go back to the judicial ethics thing for just one second.
Certainly.
I get a lot of judges elected, and it's one of the things that I'm really good at, and it's sort of an area of expertise. And I can say this, that the people running for judge in Albany County or in New York State are held to a higher standard of ethics in terms of when they're running and what they have to do when they're in office than it seems that the U.S. Supreme Court judges are held to. And that's, to me, you know, bizarre in a sense, because these are family court judge, county court, city court, you know, state Supreme Court. They're held to ethical standards that the U.S. Supreme Court seems to have just said, doesn't apply to us, at least some of them.
Matthew writes into panel at WAMC.org and says, Citizens United is the case to look at if you'd like to explore when the Supreme Court lost its legitimacy. Mm. At that point, it had become a tool for the ruling class. Since then, the corruption has not become worse. It's just become more blatant. And Patricia writes in and says, money is what happened at the Supreme Court. Certain members think it's fine for big money to have a big influence, a la Citizens United. Jim?
Well, I mean, they're very... very bad. Bad is the best word I can come up with. Very bad Supreme Court decisions throughout the history of our country. And there seems to have been an ability to have a corrective over time. And so I don't think we should look back at the past with rose-colored glasses. I mean, there's been some really terrible decisions throughout the entire history of the country. So as Teresa was saying, you know, the philosophical shifts is one thing, and that those are issues that are going to be in one way or another, explicitly or implicitly, on the ballot. But the code of conduct, I mean, I think, you know, the way Libby put it, you know, family court judge in Albany County is held to a higher standard than the Supreme Court justices.
Mm-hmm.
That really kind of says it all.
In the past, maybe you didn't think you had to. Well, interesting, because I was focusing on the Civil Rights Act, the history of it. Right in front of me, I have the date. So you think about 1896, Plessy versus Ferguson, right? And that's, you know, separate but equal, right? And
that's just one of the terrible
decisions. And it
decisions.
Took till 1964, right? And
54, Brown versus Board of
Education. Oh, that's right. You're right.
Reversed it.
Right. But also the Civil Rights Act also, right, mm-hmm. had an implication to it. But you're right. I'm sorry about that. But it took a long time. And it took a lot of work by people, you know, to raise awareness about the implications of it. And so I think that those are, in a way, philosophical changes, right? But I think those are different than ethical changes. I am interested in the term limits. I think that needs to be debated, not the fact that we need them, but what the timing should be.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. It's time now for a brief news break with the BBC, and we will return and conclude this morning's program after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc, joined this morning by Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Ketterer, and Libby Post. The email address to join the conversation is panel@wamc.org. We will now move on to discussions of another relatively nearby in the world election. This morning, several countries, including the United States and some Latin American nations, have cast doubt on the results of Venezuela's presidential election and called for transparency in voting after President Nicolas Maduro's Electoral Council declared him the winner. United States Secretary of State Antony Blinken said, "We have serious concerns that the result announced does not reflect the will or the votes of the Venezuelan people." He called on electoral officials to publish the detailed tabulation of votes, adding, "The international community is watching this very closely and will respond accordingly." Some Latin American countries, including Colombia, which has friendly ties to Maduro, also expressed skepticism of the results, as did Spain, Italy, and other European nations. Russia, China, Iran, and Cuba were among those to congratulate Maduro. Venezuela's pre-government electoral council said early Monday morning, that's this morning, after partial results, that Maduro won 51% of the vote to the opposition candidate Edmundo González's 44%, despite independent polling suggesting that González won twice as many votes as Maduro. An authoritarian socialist, Maduro has been in power since 2013, and many blame him for the oil-rich country's economic collapse and the exodus of millions of citizens, including hundreds of thousands who have fled to the United States. González also claimed victory late Sunday, saying the results are undeniable. The country elected a peaceful change. Jim Ketterer.
Yeah, so the first thing I want to do is just take a step back and have us just remember that this year, 2024, is a massive year for elections around the world. I mean, so the elections in Venezuela are part of this year of elections. 64 countries are having elections. 49% of the world's population are going to the polls this year. And that's not a normal year. Obviously, we're having our own elections as well. And so, jumping off of what Secretary of State Blinken said about publishing the details, I think it's just crucially important that for all of these elections that have gone on and are still to come, including our own this year, that it's important that there's a transparency to them and that there is some sense that the international community writ large, that we're all holding each other to some basic standards of free and fair elections, not getting into necessarily the details, the legal aspects of each country, but just the basic standards of free and fair elections. There are going to be, just on a side note, there are going to be international observers that come to our elections this November. And it's an organization that I've worked with as well. And we, the United States, are a member organization. We've signed a treaty to be a member of this organization. But oftentimes, some of the states in our country do not welcome them, do not give them access. That doesn't send a good sign. And so to the details of Venezuela, you know, this is a place that matters a lot. You were mentioning, Sarah, that, you know, the huge oil reserves, the spillover of people fleeing, the economic collapse there around the world, including to the United States, which has political implications here as well. The idea that the current president, who is the protege of the previous president, Hugo Chavez, who came to power in 1998, so these two have been in power a very long time, you know, follow the dictatorial playbook. Control the legislature, control the military, control the judiciary, control the election council, control most of the media, and control the violent paramilitary gangs that roam the country. So if anybody wants to, you know, have a good sense of how that playbook works and how it might be applied other places, including our own place, Venezuela is a kind of an exact model of that. And so, you know, we see that the opposition leader has also declared victory. But I heard this morning that the opposition is urging calm from their supporters, and they're not saying let's flood into the streets. And there's already been crackdowns. There's already a UN report from 2020 that says Maduro should be held accountable for crimes against humanity. So they know that the response will be quick and violent and deadly. What happens next in the next few days is anybody's guess, but, you know, high tension with real implications for the United States. Venezuela is an ally of China and Russia and Iran.
Cuba, Bolivia, and Honduras.
Yeah. So for all of those reasons, I'm sure the State Department is working overtime, seeing what happens next and what the implications are for U.S. foreign policy. And for American domestic politics as well.
Libby?
Well, I think Jim pretty much said it all. I mean, this guy is just a strong man. The fact that he calls himself as a socialist is a joke. You know, he's just a strong man. And they've pretty much undermined Venezuela's economy. You know, there are so many people fleeing from there. There needs to be change. The people want to change. I put more faith in the exit polls than I do in the actual results that the country is reporting, you know, the ruling party is reporting. I think he lost. And as we know, strong men don't like that. And so, you know, we had October 6th here, or January 6th here, and we'll see what happens there. But there needs to be a change. And our foreign policy history with Latin America and South America has not been great. But if we could work behind the scenes to actually put in a democratic leader, that would be great, because what our history has been is to put strong men in that we can control. Now we've got a strong man in there that we can't control.
Teresa.
Yeah. Again, this is not my area, so I don't know Venezuela that well, but I do. This is really what I worry about for the U.S. And I think after January 6th and you know, what happened in the last election, it's harder and harder for us to push back on things like this, right? Because they see what happens in our own country. And I think there's so many lessons for us to learn. And we think, you know, people may think Venezuela, why do we care about their elections? But I think there's a lot to learn, positive and negative. I think some of the photos that I saw of people, even though there was a fear or concern that this would not be a legitimate election, enormous numbers of people came out to vote. Right, mm-hmm. long lines. They came out before dawn. They lined up down the streets and through the alleys. It was this incredible picture of just long lines of people, because they're using their precious right to vote. And I think it behooves us to all remember that. And then this threat of violence in the streets at the very end of the New York Times story on this, tucked at the very end, was a person who was concerned that Maduro would do exactly what he's doing, which is declare victory in what appeared to be not a victory. And he said that they would there need to be demonstrations. And he said, quote, "I'm praying that doesn't come to that, because obviously a lot of people are going to die." And that's why I think it's so important that the opposition is urging people, at least as of this morning, don't go out into the streets, because that could get bloody. But I think that both for our own election system and for the impact this has been having and will continue to have on immigration and on movement of people, and including into the U.S., there's been a huge influx of Venezuelans into the U.S. in the last few years. We really need to pay attention.
You know, one of the ways that the U.S. has been pushing back on the current Venezuelan regime is with sanctions. And I also think it behooves us as Americans to think long and hard about the way that we use sanctions. The use of them has exploded over the past several presidential administrations. And it's pretty clear that sanctions work in certain cases that have certain conditions, or a very specific goal. international cooperation on the sanctions, and that they're highly targeted. That apparently is not what is going on with the U.S. sanctions in Venezuela, and they can have a real kind of blowback effect. If you look back at the sanctions that we imposed on Iraq, for instance, between the two wars, they largely enhanced the power of Saddam Hussein, enriched Saddam and his regime, and turned the population against the United States, and really were the subject of a lot of profound criticism around the world. And so they sound easy. They sound kind of no cost to us in many ways. But, you know, I think that if the response from the U.S. is to say we're going to double down on these sanctions, or we're going to continue the sanctions or something like that, that American citizens ought to question that, and they ought to question their members of Congress about whether that's a wise course of action.
So what do you do? Because it has created economic hardship in Venezuela that has then driven people out, and the people who leave are the people who can afford to leave, right? And that influx has come into the United States, which has caused pressure here. And so I agree that the sanctions don't always work. They backfire. But what are the tools in the toolbox then?
Yeah, I think, well, if you want to use sanctions, and you have to do it in the way that we know that they work and that apparently is not in place with these current sanctions. So then you have to...
These are economic sanctions.
Right. You have to find a way to... I'm sure there's travel sanctions on some of the leadership as well. But the economic sanctions are...
A flow of goods and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, and
right.
It's really a blunt instrument. Ends up hurting a lot of the population that are already suffering from the economic mismanagement of the country. You're hurting the very people that you're saying you're trying to help, and you're not hurting the regime that you're saying you're trying to hurt. And so, you know, I think, you know, figuring out, can you get the elements in place to make the sanctions effective is one. And if not, coming up with another set of policies. And as Libby said, you know, we don't have a good history in the region, and would we be able to muster up the cooperation of the other countries in the region to work with us? I'm not sure if that's the case or not. But, you know, just continuing to enact and maybe to double down on a policy that doesn't work, that sounds like that's not a good start.
One of the things that this is a sidebar about Vice President Harris, one of the tasks that she's had for the last 2 or 3 years is to be in that region, talk to the leadership about what the root causes are of migration. And so she comes into this having spent a couple of years interacting with leaders in Central and South America. And so I think that kind of experience, while it doesn't get to this precise question, the broader issue of leadership on this issue, she's been doing a lot of work on that, for which the Trump administration is criticizing her. But in fact, looking at the root causes, is, I think, over time is essential.
Yeah.
Root causes of migration.
We also didn't mention this conversation that Maria Corina Machado, who is a very popular politician in Venezuela, had won the primary, but then Maduro's control prevented her from running, so she put her support behind Gonzalez, and we'll see what happens next. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Let me see if we have any letters here, and we don't. How bizarre.
There must be some Venezuelan experts out there who could write to us.
Well, if they do now, we're not going to have time to read it before the end of the show, but I'm sure they are out there formulating their thoughts, and we will, of course, discuss this again in the future. Our panel this morning was public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois. Good to see you, Teresa. Thank you for being here.
Delighted to be here. Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Senior fellow at Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer. A pleasure, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you.
And, of course, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, in recovery at home. Good healing to you, Libby, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Of
you
course.
Thanks.
The panel will be posted online at WAMC.org a little bit after 11 a.m. if you'd like to check it out there. You can also find it in the WAMC app or available where you find your podcasts, as they say. Once again, the panel music this morning was by Pat Metheny from his new album Moondial, and the playlist will be posted online at WAMC.org/roundtable. The Congressional Corner is next. Thank you.